So a lot of people talk about training special operations groups, the secret agencies and all of that. And that may or may not be true in some of their cases. But today I'm going to bring you a guy that is absolutely immersed in it. Does not talk about it, you know, but it's the real deal. He's not an Instagram, you know, junkie. He's not a selfie guy. He's not a self-promoter that way. He is a trainer par excellence. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about this guy. Tom Kyer from SIOC Tactical Group. I got to meet Tom a couple months ago in person, finally, at a conference that we were both speaking at. In fact, that's a picture of him at the conference. And I meet a lot of guys in the industry, but I just really connected with him on the way he looks at the subject of violence, how he trains, how his men train, and how he lives his life. So you probably are never going to get a chance to train personally with Tom, but this is your opportunity to learn from him, and I take full advantage of it. This is a three-part series. He just goes in-depth on so many just principled items. His background is amazing. You know, he basically grew up, he was a tough kid from day one, you know, learned to box, learned judo, learned how to grapple, wrestling, very, very accomplished, you know, tested his skill sets in the toughest bars in Philadelphia as a bouncer. And as he'd clean out each bar, he'd go to the next one because he didn't want to be someplace where he didn't get a chance to test his skills. And then he had a chance meeting, you know, he didn't think much of martial arts at all. And a friend of his really wanted to go to this one martial arts demonstration. Tom accompanied him. He didn't really think much of what he saw so far, figured he'd test it out. He did, and he tore through the person that he tested out. But when he looked at his body, he realized how that guy had a real knife in his hand instead of a marker. He would have bled out easily and lost. And he wasn't sure how he did it. So he tried it a couple other times. And guess what? Same result every time. He understood there was a skill set and there were things that he wasn't aware of. And he just decided to absolutely immerse himself. So you're going to hear how he took it from there. And now he is literally the go-to guy for most of the deep cover people in our military. And, it's amazing the way they look at the subject and the way they continually improve their methods. So without further ado, Tom Kyer. Tom, great to have you on the channel. Been meaning to get you on for quite some time. Ever since, you know, I mean, I've known of you for years and I have a couple of mutual friends that we know, and getting to meet you in LA was great because, you know, like I was telling you earlier, it's rare when oftentimes the person you meet matches what you've been told, and you more than did that. Your presentation there was fantastic. And, I really want to share, you know, your methods and your principles, you know, with everybody. But I think what's really important was you started out in LA talking about your background. And your background, I think, is absolutely critical, you know, for people to understand, because I'm sure later on we're going to make some statements that might be controversial in the industry, quote unquote, but it's well-grounded. Your methods and your thoughts are well-grounded, and because of where you came from. Could you just share with everybody kind of your background, what you came up from, and the fact that what I think is a common theme that I'm seeing with a lot of the people that I you know, subject matter experts I bring on here. The fact that it could have gone either way, meaning you could have gone down the criminal path if you wanted to. It's usually there's this point where you got to make that decision. And, you know, what's interesting is somebody comes into your life at that time or an event comes into your life that time that just ends up sending you down the road. Yeah. So could you start there with everybody and just kind of let them know a little bit about your background?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Tim. My background, as you alluded to, you know, I had a very violent kind of upbringing. You know, I was in a household that was you know, violence was an everyday thing. And it really didn't bother me. I kind of looked at it as that this is the way everyone lives, and this is the way life is, you know. So to me, there was no there was nothing shocking about it, or nothing out of the ordinary. I was attracted to violent sports and combative sports, and you know, I played football and wrestled mostly a lot of wrestling when I was young, and then boxing, and you know, I grew up when I was young outside of Philly, 30 miles or so outside of Philly, but then moved closer to Philly as I was a teenager. And boxing is a big thing there as well. So, you know, I was around, had access to wrestling and boxing as ways to as outlets. And later on, you know, I was also attracted to, you know, more violence when I was a teenager and early 20s. And I started working in bars as a bouncer. I was, you know, I was a 300-pound boxer wrestler, and I knew that I could make money, you know, kicking people out of bars and keeping the peace. But really, for me, it was an outlet for me to fight. And I worked in a number of bars that, you know, maybe were a little violent when I got there. But I put everyone on notice that if you're going to fight in this bar, you're going to fight me. And people stopped fighting in the bars that I was working in. And so then I would quit the bar and I would move to another bar that was had a violent reputation, where I knew I could get in a lot of fights. So I did that when I was in my early 20s, and you know, was involved in other things that were, you know, I was like hired muscle for different people around Philly for collecting money, sending messages to people, et cetera, that kind of stuff, like crazy stuff that you do when you're young and you don't really know any better, you know? But I was definitely going down a bad path, you know, a path that could have been disastrous. I was in hundreds and hundreds of fights and confrontations, and I enjoyed it, but in the back of my head, I knew that this is, you know, not sustainable. This is not something that you do. And a friend of mine who we had come up wrestling together, we were working at some of the bars together, and he wanted to get into more traditional martial arts. And at that time, I didn't look at martial arts very favorably. I looked at martial arts as kind of a joke. You know, in the hundreds of fights that I had, you know, anyone who was known as a martial artist couldn't fight. You know, there were guys who had never done anything and were street fighters that would crush those kind of classical martial art guys. You know, some guy who's a black belt in karate or something. Right. And everyone, you know, would state at some point, if they had a martial art background, they would let people know, you know, that they're a black belt or something like that. And of course, just destroying the reputation of those martial arts, because all of those guys get crushed. And, you know, they take some kind of stance, very rigid, and they just get steamrolled and stomped on the ground like somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. And basically they didn't know what they were doing. Now I consider wrestlers and boxers to be martial artists, but, you know, they don't consider themselves to be martial artists necessarily. They don't necessarily look at it that way. So, you know, when I say martial artists, I mean everyone who would classically say that, you know. And so I didn't really care about getting, but he was my best friend. He's my training partner when it came to wrestling and boxing and stuff. So he's like, hey, I want to do martial arts. I'm like, all right, fine. You know, he liked to watch like Kung Fu Theater on Saturdays and stuff like that. So right. I was like, okay, it's goofy, but I'll go with you and do this. And so we would go down to this martial arts school. It was a Kung Fu studio. And, you know, he had fun. And, but I started to meet some martial artists, and not all the martial artists that I met were inept kind of fighters. There were some of them that could handle themselves, and, they just weren't the guys, going out to bars at night fighting. So, you know, there was a whole group of martial artists that I met that, you know, they were capable individuals, you know? So we got into it, and eventually I met Chris Sayoc, who ended up being my teacher for 30 years after that, you know? So, and this was Sayoc Kali, which is a Filipino martial art, dealt with blades and weapons. And, you know, I had an interesting kind of, introduction. Meaning I still was very skeptical, and you know, I squared off with a guy who you know, as a test, you know, we squared off. He had a black magic marker, and I told him I was going to take it off. And so we started moving around a little bit, and I am not you know, I had no etiquette. You know, it was like I would bare knuckle punch anyone in the face and be like, hey man, don't be a pussy. Like, you know, you that bleeding will stop. You know, don't whine and cry to me about it, you know. So I was hard on him, you know. Like I grabbed the guy and I choked him and threw him and punched him and took the marker off of him. And I say, you want to try it again, you know? And he said, well, look at your neck, look at your chest, look at, and I had marks all over me that I never felt during the altercation. And I realized that I'd be bleeding out right now, you know? And I thought, man, that's not good. So we went at it a couple more times, and I was rough on him every time, but I could not stop him from killing me with that magic marker. And I was like, wow, this is something I really need to, you know, get a handle on. So that really was an eye-opening experience for me. And I got into Filipino arts, martial arts, and blade arts. And that was about 1990. And, you know, over the years, I had met some really good martial artists, but that was my introduction into really being serious about it. And, you know, I continued that study, but it was a good thing. And my instructor, Christopher Castaneda Sayoc Sr., who was the head of the Sayoc system, was also a mentor for me in getting me out of the thug life that I was getting into, and, gave me a lot of ways to channel aggression, understand violence, and kind of come to grips with, you know, navigating the world in a way that wasn't going to be completely destructive. And, you know, I credit him with me away from a life that would have been, you know, dead or in jail by the time I was 25, you know, kind of life. So, yeah, so that was my kind of introduction. But, you know, and I'd always loved weapons too. You know, I was big into archery and shooting, you know, competed even at that time in some, competition shooting sports. But, a real scientific understanding of weapons was something I did not have either. So, so a lot came from my introduction and kind of mentorship given to me by Chris Sayoc. So.
Yeah, it's you said an interesting thing. I grew up on military bases, and so boxing and wrestling, that's Marines yeah. taught us all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was weird when I got into martial arts originally, back when I, because it's real different today, but back then it was mostly the Korean arts were available. That was yeah. basically it. So I did Tungsido, I had an instructor out there in San Diego. But what was weird was when I went in, you said the etiquette thing. It was like, you weren't allowed to do what you could do.
That's right.
And it was always strange to me. And then every time the actual guy that taught me actually was a good fighter. He was actually a good street fighter. Mm-hmm. But what was really weird was every time I would say, hey, I ran into this situation and I tried to, no, you want to do this. And he'd show me something that was completely different from what we were training. And he said something to me that stuck with me the rest of my life. He goes, no. He goes, that's the art. He goes, that's the art. Here's how you fight. This is how you fight. Boom. And I said, well, why don't you show that all the time? He goes, oh, cause that's just fighting. Like he literally delineated like the two. Yeah. He knew that, but in my mind, I was just like, I got to know how to fight,
And, yeah.
So it was interesting. It was interesting having that effect, but back then, especially in those days, like you said, those guys were just getting torn apart, Yeah. That was the one thing, like nothing added up. I saw just a country boy who this black belt, quote unquote, at a school just cut in line with him. This kid didn't even, he comb grabbed the back of his hair, kicked his feet out from under him and just pounded his head on the lunch tray table and just yeah. dropped his ass, And that to yeah. me was just like, we thought the other guy was unbeatable, by his reputation.
Yeah.
And you quickly cut through all that stuff. Now, that's juvenile and but it's very important because that embeds in your head. And
that's right.
What I thought was interesting was you gave a full pressure test on these guys and you were able to pull your ego back to see, oh shit. Yeah. It is a magic marker, but if that was a knife,
yeah.
this would have happened to me and I have something that I can learn here. And I think that's probably the key is when as a young guy, the first time you can check yourself and open up to maybe a different approach, I think that's huge. And, yeah. And then you took it. So you went and you found Chris and you immersed yourself in Cali and you changed kind of your path on how you're going. You quickly, you became one of the lead guys in there. Can you talk, what I think is so interesting about what you guys do, and probably for the uninitiated, we should talk a little bit about Cali, Sayoc Cali and how it is. It's your, I don't want to jump ahead to where you're currently at and what you're doing, but what's interesting is the transition and how, again, it was recognized in other communities, military communities and stuff. The same kind of thing, same kind of value was recognized when they were introduced to people that had been trained in it. What was your purpose? So you guys started training, obviously in Philadelphia, you're in the Philadelphia area. And then how did it all evolve from there? When did you guys start integrating people? I imagine like most places, one or two operators probably trickle in as yeah. trainers, and then the word gets out. And then, it's usually how it happens.
Yeah. I was interested in military stuff and interested in getting into the military. I had some bumps along the way that would make it a little harder for me to get in. Right. I was on the I was a thug back then, It wasn't something that the discipline and the structure of the military was not something. I had a problem with authority is what it was. And very authoritative system, the military. So, but I respected warriors and I respected the guys who were doing the job. I had come to my teacher, Tuan Chris Sayoc, and I said, Tuan, I want to look at possibly building a program that we could train military guys, because everyone kind of picked their area that they were interested in. And there were guys that opened up, you know, schools to train kids because that's what they were interested in. Right. And, you know, there are guys who did, you know, women's self-defense or whatever, but I was interested in military stuff. And I know that he had trained the military before in the 70s, I believe, or maybe early 80s. But, and I asked him, I went to him and said, Tuan, I'd like to, you know, look at developing something for the military. And he says, yeah, that's a great idea. Why don't you do that? I thought, okay.
Hey, Tom, just to clarify for everybody, yeah. Tuan, can you explain the ranking system? Like, oh,
what is yeah. So Tuan just is a master instructor. So, the head of the system is called Pamana Tuhan, which is like the headmaster of the system. But after about 20 years of training, you can, so that's how long it takes to attain the rank. And the rank is based on a whole bunch of different things. You know, some of it is technical knowledge, some of it is application. Some of it is deeds that are done within the tribe, within the system, and, you know, accomplishments. And so I obtained the rank of Tuhan in, I think, 2007. So I had been in the system for about 17 years when I got the Tuhan rank. But, you know, we refer to when we say Tuhan or Pamana Tuhan, we mean the head of the system, who he has since died, but at that time was Pamana Tuhan Christopher Castaneda Sayoc Sr. Now, there are probably, I don't even know what the count is on number of Tuhans in the system now, but it's, you know, it's somewhere around 10 probably. Mm-hmm. And these guys have all spent 20 plus years in the system and completely dedicated to it. And then we have full instructors, who are, you know, 1 through 10 ranked full instructors. And then we have, associate level instructors. And then below that we have apprentice level. And then we have students. Then these are people who aren't looking to become instructors. They're just training in the system. And there aren't any various ranks of students. So student rank, but then if you want to be an instructor, you'll end up going through your apprenticeship, then you'll go into an associate rank, then you'll go into a full instructor rank, and then you would get your Tuhan rank. So that is somewhere around 20, 25 years typically to do that. So yeah, so that's the basic ranking structure of the system. And you know, we really didn't have a lot of that structure, because when I got into the system, it wasn't a public system. It was a private family-based system that was handed down father to son over, you know, dozens of generations. So it can be traced back in the Philippines for, you know, probably over 500 years on paper, mostly documented from the Spanish, who had obviously been fighting a war in the Philippines to conquer it. And that fight had gone on for hundreds of years, but the Sayoc tribe or area of the mountainous regions of the Philippines was recognized by the Spanish as a problem. And the Sayocs come from that area. So, you know, there's documentation and father to son kind of handing down of the system. So that's the structure of the system, and that's what I you know, got into in the early 90s. But so, you know, I was talking to Tuan Sayoc, and I said, you know, I wanted to do this, and he said, yeah, it's a great idea, go ahead. And then that was it. I said, well, what, you know, what's the next thing? He's like, I figured out. you know? So I was like, okay.
Classic answer.
Yeah. And so anyway, I had just kind of focused on curriculum that was applicable for that type of outlet of the art. And the art is very big. I mean, it's hundreds of years. So we have just so much information in the art, and some of it is not being taught anymore. But you can find the documentation on it. And I went back to the stuff that was used during World War II, during Spanish-American War, and started studying some of that old material that was in the system. And it was like century removals and all kinds of stuff that, if you have a martial arts school teaching kids, it's not the stuff that you teach them. But
right.
But it was all still there. And so I started studying a lot of that and looking at some of the more aggressive applications of blade work. Once again, not something that the general population is going to be attracted to. So I started focusing on that a little bit in the system. And I was studying with Tom Brown because I was also interested in kind of bringing up all of the skill sets that I thought were important. So, you know, whether it is capability, medical capabilities, driving, shooting, picking locks, man tracking, pretty much any kind of something that I thought was interesting and something that I was attracted to. So anyway, I was at Tom Brown's school for tracking. And
Tom's legendary.
Yeah, yeah. And so I was studying down there with Tom Brown quite a bit. And there's a lot of Navy SEALs that also go through Tom Brown's school. So when I was down there, I ended up meeting some of these Navy SEALs that were coming through doing training with Tom. And that was my first time where I really was able to sit down and discuss combatives with an active military guy. And we had some great conversations and great training down there. So we would train every chance we got when we were down there. And he was really the individual who ended up getting us hooked up with the SEAL teams. And this was like 1997, maybe.
Right.
And 1998, something like that, maybe. And then I would make trips to visit those guys down in Virginia Beach. And I would just head down and we would train for 3 days or whatever. And then I would head back up to Philly. And I did this for a few years. And then 9/11. And then that was everything changed, you know, everything changed as you remember. And the funny thing is there's guys that I'm training now that don't remember that were too young, crazy. You know, it's crazy, right?
Yeah.
But after that, everyone went into, you know, and I had been training, I had, you know, 50 guys probably down at Virginia Beach who I had trained from, you know, 1997 to 2001. And then things started getting really pretty hot, you know? And so that was that was why we were so established with the SEAL teams, was because of that initial contact with them. And, you know, a lot of those guys ended up progressing through the SEAL teams and these are the guys who were really serious about combatives and very serious about fighting and training on their own off in their off time.
Right.
And they're the same types of people who progress through any system or through any organization. You know, they're the go-getters, you know, the guys who are doing extra. And of course they progress to damn neck. And And then we ended up being invited down there to do work with them. And, you know, the system, and this was from Tuhan, he said, you know, if you develop this curriculum with the military, it needs to be organic. And, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, organic, like it just grows however it's supposed to grow or something like that. He's like, no, it means there needs to be a feedback loop. Organic systems have feedback loops. So it's not static. It's not dead. You know, it has a living element to it. And that living element is all of the different feedback loops feed back in to the direction that you go, the development of curriculum, feedback from the guys coming from downrange, coming back home from downrange, and immediately incorporating any of their questions and stuff that they learned downrange needs to be fed back in, and then it needs to be developed. So it needs to constantly be developed. He said, you know, don't fall in love with anything because everything has a shelf life, and you know, it's not going to be traditional, because traditional means it doesn't change. Right. This is going to be organic. It's going to grow. It's going to shape. It's going to shift with the battlefield, which is ever changing. You know, the thing that people need to understand is you cannot be static. Static is death, right? Life is movement. So change is life. So the thing is, because the enemy that we're fighting is constantly trying to change to win, right? So the enemy that you're fighting is always going to make adjustments because they're not winning, they're losing. Right. So they're not going to keep doing the same thing. They're going to change, which means by definition, you also must change, because your enemy's changing. If you stay the same and he changes to beat you, and you don't follow suit and keep evolving, he's going to answer all those questions that he couldn't answer, and you're going to start to lose. So the definition must be that we need to change. You know, that's something that is a assured thing. So, you know, we need that feedback loop. We need the ability to change. We need flexibility. We need as the battle space changes. So, you know, the rules of engagement, where we're fighting, how we're fighting, what we're doing, technology changes. So all of these things will feed back in to the curriculum. And so we're on the cutting edge of what needs to be done. And so that's how we developed it. And, you know, the guys in the military develop their tactics the same way, you know. Now you want to do this proactively, right? So we want to do these changes before we need to do them. So we want to be one step ahead of the absolute necessity to make the change, because the necessity to make the change is when you find out you failed. Right. So people start to die, right? And then all of a sudden enough people die and people start to reluctantly change. And these are, you know, reactive people. We want to be proactive, you know.
What's the nuance in that, Tom? Like when you get the feedback loop with the operators, they're coming back from downrange, they give you stuff. How were you guys able to see something coming? Okay, we got to make some changes, you know, like ahead of time, because I think that's just so key. And also just the reason I love to point this out to everybody is this is what dealing with the environment's all about, real environment of dealing with violence and everything, and understanding what you're up against, understanding things change, things aren't the way you wish them to be. They are a certain way. Yeah. And where would you guys somebody come back, probably give you a little bit of information and go, oh, okay, we got to be able to deal with that ahead of time.
Yeah. So, you know, sometimes they would get off the plane and literally show up, and they would have a list of questions like immediately. Sometimes it was, you know, sitting around because a big part of our training cycle is, you know, we start the training blocks, we train throughout the day, And at night we're going to eat together. So we're going to have a meal together. And, you know, that is a natural cycle that has been part of the, at least the male condition, you know, probably for the last 40,000 years. You know, you hunt together, you prepare for the hunt, sharpen your weapons, make your weapons, get everything you need together. You then hunt together. You start running and moving and killing. You process together, clean the animals, and afterwards you all sit down, you eat, right? So we look at that same cycle as just part of what it, of being a warrior or being a man, you know. So we train together, we sweat and bleed and repair afterwards, and medical management and stuff like that. But afterwards we have to sit down and share a meal. And a lot of times it's around the fire. It's around the meal table where things start, you know, concerns start coming forward, things that happened overseas, kind of the in-depth philosophical talks about where the scope of the battle space is changing, what kind of things that we've heard or seen that are precursors to a big change that's happening, and things that need to be addressed. And then we you know, develop that plan of action, maybe sometimes you're right around the table. And then we'll start putting it into the curriculum and testing it and pressure testing it. So a lot of what we do is to look at technique and stuff like that, and then pressure test it in different environments with people who are, you know, looking to really pressurize it. So, you know, mouthpieces get put in and people are in certain situations, and we're constantly looking for ways to do that. But it is a process, and it's something that needs to be, you know, addressed consciously. You know, it will happen unconsciously to a certain degree, but not nearly to the level of thoroughness that we need to have. So we need to really consciously develop these feedback loops and listen to what they're telling us, you know. And so, you know, sometimes it was mistakes that were made, and other times it was just recognizing trends, that people can see patterns of how things are going. And a lot of times it's putting yourself in the enemy's position and say, well, if you were this enemy and this had happened to you five times,
right,
you know, what would you do differently? Like, and I've heard you talk about, you know, similar things, is that, you know, the guy you're fighting one-on-one with is doing this on his OODA loop. Like, he's doing this in a, he's trying to figure out how to win. And this can happen in milliseconds in an engagement. He may change his complete strategy. He may change his application of technique in some way that he thinks is going to serve him better. And you have to be able to see that. So on a time scale that's very compressed and very tight, we're doing the same thing, you know, and we're also doing it on a large scale that may be decades, you know, of change. So, but it's constantly happening, you know. These are dynamic situations, and it's just the nature of violence, you know. It's not static. It's not preset. You know, the first casualty of every battle is the battle plan. So if you go in thinking that you're going to know everything that's going to happen in any engagement, I mean, that's foolish and it's a waste of your time, you know. Better to be flexible and plan to be flexible and give yourself a lot of different tools to put into the toolbox. So if you need a different tool, you can reach into the box and get it. So that's part of flexibility. Part of flexibility is having the ability to fight on the ground, fight on your feet, grapple, strike, use weapons, produce weapons from everywhere. These are all formulas that you're developing so that you can be flexible, so that you don't have to have a plan that is, you know, a 32-step plan that you follow from 1 to 32, because that's not going to happen. That's not going to be there. So, you know, plan to be flexible.
It's also knowing, like, the one thing I really like about you guys is it's also knowing what tool to use in the environment. Meaning,
yes,
you know, if you got the same freaking hammer for every, you know, every nail, you're just done. And that's my big, what I love about this is that the operators trust you guys, and that they're coming in and they're sharing this, because that's a hard nut to crack.
It is.
You know, I mean, you're seeing the cutting edge. You're seeing the guys that are coming back from the worst areas, most challenging areas. You know, we talked a little bit about this in LA, but I'd really like you to elaborate on it. I mean, it doesn't seem to me, oftentimes, you guys are very mission focused, and it doesn't seem that a lot of these other programs necessarily help the mission. They don't, you know, they're not bad, but they're just, I think they give a false sense in some ways.
Yeah, they're not optimized. I mean, some of these are, you know, some of these other guys who are involved in combatives as part of a contractor who does combatives for the military. Some of the guys are, first of all, they're looking at a program that may be, hey, we're going to teach 50,000 Marines or Army guys or something like that. So that program has to be structured to facilitate that. And you can't try to do what we're doing and teach 10,000 people at a mil, like it wouldn't work. You know, right. you would have to structure it differently. So, you know, in their defense, that's like what they have to do to teach that many people.
Yeah.
There are some people out there who really, they're looking at it as an opportunity to make money, and it's a business, and they're structuring it as a business. And, you know, they show up to teach, you know, a unit somewhere, and they'll show up by themselves, or they won't even show up. They'll send one of their flunkies to go do it.
Right.
And, you know, when I show up to train 20 guys, I bring 10 instructors. Yeah. Like, I show up with 10 instructors. By the way, all those instructors are master level instructors.
Right.
You know, we roll deep, because I know that, realistically, that's what we need to do to impart this knowledge in any kind of realistic way in the 40 hours that we have for this contract or whatever. That, you know, sometimes the contracts are 2 weeks, but in most cases, you're just getting a week with these guys on their workup. So what do I need to do to optimize the transfer of information and to answer all the questions that are unique to each of these individuals? I need to have enough instructors there to do that. So, you know, that costs a lot of money to bring those guys, but you know what? It's worth it for what we're doing.
Right.
I see some people in the combatives area that are kind of deluded. You know, they're not connected to reality anymore, or maybe they never were, but they are very good at marketing. They're very good at selling themselves. You know, they're probably really awesome on Instagram or, you know, I really don't do much of that. You know, we're really word of mouth for us. If you go to our website, SIAC Tactical Group, it's like something that some guy made up as like a bare minimum. Cause you have to have a place to go to.
Right.
But we don't do any business through there. You know, all the business is some guy calling me, usually from a number that won't show up on my phone. And then he's, you know, hey, we want to bring you in on a contract. I'm like, okay. A lot of times I don't even know who they are, cause they won't tell me.
Right.
Like I'm trying to figure out who they are. But you know, so I just say, hey, what do you want to train in? What are you doing downrange? What's your mission set? And they'll give me some information on that. And then we'll develop a custom curriculum for that group. Now it will have a lot of similarities to other curriculums that we've done, but it will be a unique mixture of those things for that group and for what they're about to do. And so I don't see other companies really doing that. I see them kind of like, hey, this is what we're training in. And a lot of, I look at the training and I'm like, you know, I think back to all those guys in some kind of horse stance, you know, like with a locked in reverse punch, like chambered on their hip,
right,
jumping around in the alleyways, and me just looking over at this guy who I just hired to work in the bar as a bouncer, and I'm watching him hop around, and I'm like, what is that guy doing over there? Yeah. And he's not effective at all. And I'm like, you know, that's not, and I'm, you know, grabbing a guy, pulling his shirt over his head and you know, looking like I'm in a hockey fight, because that works with that guy who's got that fucking hoodie on, you know, you grab, right, you pull that hoodie over his face, start punching him in through the hood.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, and I look over these martial artists and I'm like, you're fired. You know, I had to fire him. Yeah. But I look at some of these guys teaching abattis, and they have the same kind of misinterpretation of what it's really going to be like. And, you know, but they're getting hired because they have good publicists or they have good whatever, you know. And, yeah, you know, I don't have any of that stuff, but I see a lot of that in the industry, and it's, I am a little bit emotional about it, because I built enough of a relationship with the guys that are being trained that, you know, I know them, like I know their kids, their family, their wives. You know, we spend a lot of time together, you know, and a lot of them don't come home, you know? Yeah. So when I see someone out there teaching these people, you know, I'm like, hey, this is a serious thing you're doing. This is not a joke. You know, this is a guy who's about to go down range and fight. And if you give him some bad information or burn some bad reps, or that's a pretty serious thing. You know, you should take it a little bit more serious than you are. But, you know, that's the way it is. You know, you're not going to be able to, you know, first of all, I don't know everything. I might be wrong about it, but that's just my perspective, you know. But you know, there's a lot of goofiness in the combative industries, and then there's a lot of great guys too. You know, there's a lot of guys that I have a lot of respect for. You're one of them. You know, when I met you out in LA recently, you know, you were one of the guys that's like, I look at everyone who's there, I'm like, man, I really want to meet Tim Larkin, because I had known about you for a long time, and you were like, you know, I look at you, I'm like, hey, if I live near that guy, we'd be friends, because he's, yeah, a tough guy. He's like a guy that you would look at on the street and be like, yeah, that guy can handle himself. So, you know, I was happy to meet you, you know? So there's guys out there like yourself. But I would probably say there are more clowns out there than guys who are good. You know what I mean? Percentage wise, you know, the Tim Larkins are rare, but they're out there, you know?
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. It was funny you're saying that. I mean, that was what got me to go to the symposium, was I saw your name.
Yeah.
Right on. And I called a mutual friend of ours and I said, hey, I said, I'm going to go do this just because Tom's there. And so that was a great, my big strategy was to get there and meet you.
Right on. Brother. Well, I'm glad you did.
Well, I really resonate with what you're doing, dude. I mean, you're walking a really hard road, because, you have ethics and you want to give the guys what they really need, and they're able to come back to you, and you're doing it at the highest levels and of not only the military area, you're all over the place with real people.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you don't need the traditional BS that's out there. I think what's really, you know, especially for the people listening here, you know, I have this, I think I was telling you prior to the interview, when I was leaving some messages for you, kind of this idea, your talk that you gave on the three components of force, time, and space. Mm. It was one of the best strategy talks, you know, understanding real strategy in an environment that I've really ever heard of you. It's very succinct, and I think it's brilliant. And it got me to kind of pull out and say, you know, I see a lot of the industry, and I want you to share what you mm-hmm. will on that. But what it really came to me was, when you call it whatever it is. I mean, we like to just call it in the world of violence, but if right. you're going to put it in a category. I would say if you're looking for self-defense in the real world or self-protection in the real world, meaning everything's open, you know, it's the reality of the world, that requires an overall strategy. The tactics that everybody gets caught up in, the punching and kicking and all that, that's actually the easy stuff. And I don't mean, you know, you got to put the work in, but if you don't have the component, if you don't know how to conduct yourself, and let me just share the one story that got me that I knew you knew it, was during your presentation, you talked about, hey guys, I don't go out drinking with my buddies. I don't go out there. Now you're a guy who, you're a bouncer for years. You understand that. And, you know, first people are going to assume, oh, it's because you want to avoid this, or you want to avoid getting out there, which, yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. But what I thought was more interesting was the consistency of your mindset. You said, no, the reason I don't want to go out there is because I know one of you knuckleheads is going to probably drink too much and something's going to happen. And you know what my response is going to be. You're my friend and I only have one switch. And if I see anybody going for it, and he goes, you know, the repercussions of that are just not worth it for me at this stage of my life. You've got a family, you've got everything there. But what I thought was really awesome about that was you were crystal clear. I mean, it was crystal clear with how you train, how you live, and you took it into, I mean, sometimes it's probably, there's probably still, you know, the old young guy in you going, ah, it'd be kind of fun to go out with those guys, you know, because they're fun dudes and they're interesting guys. And I'm sure, you know, it'd be interesting. But I thought that statement alone kind of showed me that you get it, because if you don't have behavior modification, if you don't understand, especially once you're trained the way you're trained, that's a huge responsibility to be walking around with. You're walking around basically with your own nuclear weapon and you got to be really careful.
Yeah. That's the thing is, I was talking recently, you know, I go everywhere. I don't go anywhere without weapons on me. And most times I have multiple blades and pistols and stuff like that on me. But the thing is, when you carry around that type of stuff, you immediately need to understand how to be polite, how to avoid confrontation, because, you know, I can't afford to be sloppy. I can't afford to be callous or impolite to people, because someone else might decide to step up. And, you know, I've started something with weapons on me, and that needs to be understood, you know. And, you know, to your point about the, I tell people I'm not going to go out drinking or partying or doing any of that stuff, because we're all too dangerous for that. You know, like that's okay for the kids, but, you know, grown men who are lethal, where does that end? You know, like if you're in a situation, you know, if you go out into a situation where the statistical probability of you getting in a violent altercation is high, and you know that violent altercations are not something you're going to allow to lose. I'm not going to let some bouncers beat on me or my friends or any of that stuff. So I'm not going to sit there and allow it to happen. Well, guess what? If I don't allow it to happen, they escalate. And if they escalate, I escalate, because I'm not allowing it to happen. So where does that end? Well, unless they're skilled, unless they have all the weapons on that I have and the capability of using them, it ends up with them all dead. Yeah. Because I'm not losing. So, you know, I understand that you want to go out partying tonight, but I'm not looking to kill any bouncers tonight. So we're not going to do that. And, you know, a lot of times it's very sobering, because some of these young guys that we were training, you know, they're 20 some year old Navy SEALs, and they like to go out partying. And I tell them, let's be more professional than that, because don't act like you're a kid. Act like you're an adult who's dangerous, and be responsible and be professional. And a lot of times that sobers them right up. They immediately go, yeah, you're right. That's, you know, because I'm not saying, you know, be defensive, be safe, be cautious, because they don't want to hear that.
Right.
What I'm telling them is be dangerous.
Yeah.
And you're dangerous and you can't afford to play around with it. You know, we don't need to juggle any cleavers and pistols right now. Like, that's too dangerous. There's no reason for it. So, you know, understand that you are a dangerous person. You're a professional, and act like it, you know. And I've had that talk with a whole bunch of young SEALs who go, they turn themselves around. And with young guys of all, young men, you know, are trapped between being a kid and being a man, you know.
Yeah.
And when they choose to be a man, they start acting differently, you know. And that's all. When you see a bunch of guys out drinking at night, they're not choosing to act like men. They're acting like kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's what we talk to them about. But it is an important distinction. And it has to be clear, like you were saying, you have to be very clear and consistent in your philosophy, or else, you know, you end up running into problems, you know.
Well, yeah. Yeah. What they don't understand is if you are trained that way, and that's your mindset, if you soften that for the environment, like, okay, that's the time it happens to you, man. That's the time where the blade gets slipped in that you didn't think was there. They were coming in because you made assumptions and you let your guard down, you let your principles down, and you allowed the environment to take that away from you.
Yeah.
And it's not being defensive, it's being proactive. It's like, it's thinking ahead of time, going, okay, this environment. Yeah. And my biggest thing with people is, you know, especially when I train civilians, whether they get the nuts and bolts of being able to physically use the information, that's up to them. Meaning, you know, what work they're going to put in.
Right.
But what it does for me is when they see what it would take, if they ignore everything and they do what they want, they put themselves willingly into a situation they could have, you know, made a better decision in.
Yeah.
And they say, okay, if you're here, now you're here. And this is the minimum what it's going to take for you to get out of here. This is what you're going to have to do in another human or humans.
Yep.
And then boom. And what's great about that is my big goal is behavioral change.
Yeah.
It's that, and you're doing that for young, aggressive kids that are well-trained. And that's even a bigger service because, you know, those nothing's, I saw it happen one time in Imperial Beach when a person who thought they were invulnerable quickly found out they weren't. And in the eyes, I've never seen eyes like that. And, you know, it's just horrific. And when you see, when you see that go down to, and he's a good guy, just made a dumb decision.
Yeah.
And, didn't understand.
And, and that's the thing. We have to remember that any one of us could be there.
Oh, yeah.
Like if we, you know, nobody is immune to it, you know, when you watch, you know, and I know that you, cause I've seen your presentation and it's fantastic, but you watch video of violence happening. Hey, that could be you. That could be me. That could be anybody. There's no one's immune to it.
Yeah.
We have to understand that. Like, if you think that you can't be sucker punched or can't be, you know, shot by some thug who's running around shooting over his head. Hey, those bullets are going to hit something. They can hit you just as much as it. So, and it happens fast. And you know how fast things turn, you know, the person that you want to get in a fight with on the road or cut you off or something like that, you know, wave to him and let him go. What's the big deal? You know,
right.
Because that guy, you don't know what's going on with him, you know? And the thing is, he steps out and just starts throwing some rounds in your direction. You can catch one of them just like anybody else.
Wow.
So it's like being respectful of violence is part of it. You know, being a master of violence requires respect. You're not going to a master of it if you don't respect it, you know?
Yeah. People get strange. It's strange when like some of my true civilian friends, who really, they meet me, they think I'm a really super nice guy and just all this other stuff. And that's my shield, dude. I don't want anybody to know or think I'm a threat or I know anything. They want to think I'm a big, you know, goofy meathead. Fantastic. You know, that's exactly what I want them to think. Because if I need the information, I want it to be a total surprise.
That's right.
But you know, you, you, you really put it in a really good context. And what I tell people is, you know, if you get a chance to listen to Tom talk about, you know, the three areas of a true strategy that you really truly have to understand, you know, but you make it so easy. Like, what I loved about it was three things. You could remember them. You didn't have this whiteboard full of just garbage that made you look good. It was clear communication. Could you kind of just share that overall concept with people?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call them the elements of conflict. And, you know, it's important to understand that all conflict is made up of these three elements. And there is not a fourth element that we're leaving out. In other words, because it's a universal, meaning that it applies to all conflict universally, they get, you know, applications. There can be thousands of applications and thousands of techniques and millions of these things, because each one is a derivative of a universal or some aspect of it. So as you begin to distill anything down to its universal kind of form, they get less and less and less at the very bottom of that distillation. So as we look at conflict, or the elements are of conflict, there are only three, and that is force, space, and time. And everything in conflict is a combination of force, space, and time. And the important thing is, if you are fighting against something else, a group or an individual, there are three elements of what I'm going to be able to control. And those can also be controlled by the person that I'm fighting or the group that we're fighting. And they are force, space, and time. Now, for me to win, decisively win, I control all of those elements. Now, for me to control all three, of course, I'd first had to control two and then fight to get the last one. So the person who has two of those elements controlled is the person who's winning, but has not won yet until they get the third element. And as we begin to look at these, force, space, and time, we say, hey, force, what is it? Force is my ability to affect the enemy, the other person, my ability to physically affect them, to change what they can physically do, whether it's movement or application of violence on their part. But my force is what I have that allows me to affect them. Space is my ability to move freely or keep them from moving freely, like control choke points, free movement for flanking and breaking contact. You know, all of these types of elements of freedom of movement and range, you know, these are all control of space. So how well do I control his space? How do I take that away from him, of him being able to move freely, to change angles, to get an angle on me, or elevation, or high ground? You know, this is all controlling space. And then the last is time. So force, space, and time. Time is the element of initiative, like who has the initiative. You know, I talk about it in chess. You know, and by the way, chess is a conflict. If you play chess, there are only three elements of that conflict, which is force, space, and time. Force are the pieces that you have on the board that can attack. Space is your ability to move these and attack along range or angle or distance of some sort, your freedom of movement. And time is tempo in chess. So that's how they refer to it in chess, is tempo. And that just means I have the initiative. I could be the black pieces or the white pieces, it doesn't matter. But in this game of chess, the other person is responding to me if I have tempo, if I have time. In other words, I move a piece on the board, he must respond to that or lose something valuable to him. Right. He can't do what he thought he was going to do. He's going to respond to what I just did. And that sets up a relationship of feeder and receiver. So the feeder is the person who has time on his side, and he is initiating some event that the receiver must respond to rather than play the game that they want to play. Rather, that their plan has to go away and they have to respond to the plan that I'm initiating. Now, because of that, they are behind in time and they never get a chance to actually develop their plan. They're constantly just defending and blocking and looking to protect themselves from what I'm doing. Now, the same thing happens in a fight, right? If you control time in a fight, you initiate, you cause them to respond to that initial attack of some sort, and they begin blocking, defending, parrying, avoiding, not doing what they want to do, but trying not to get their head knocked off. Right. They're covering. Now, in that time that they were doing that, I mount another attack. They then have to respond to that new attack, not with what they wanted to do, but with some defensive posturing. And then they take up their turn doing that. And then I attack again, and I attack again. And each time they try to defend. Rather than formulate and execute their plan, they are just trying not to die. And eventually, because a certain percentage of these attacks will get through, they will cause disruption. They will cause chaos. They will cause more delay in their ability to deal with things. So, you start a fight off and you hit a guy with a straight right hand and you hit him right on the button. Let's say you don't knock him out, but you definitely put him on his heels. He's bringing his hands up, trying not to get hit again. And while he does that, I throw another punch. And then I throw another one and another one and another one. And pretty much he ends up being standing fetal position or on the ground in a fetal position. And he is not even trying to fight anymore. He's just trying not to die. Well, that's how you win. That's how you win everything. So, in a two armies that are facing each other, you control force, space, and time. You, with the force that you have, you cross space, you confine them, and you hit them before they hit you. You're ahead in time, and you maintain that initiative with constant pressure that is, what we like to call steady pressure, and just, ball them up, ball those guys up. And it's analysis of force, space, and time. Now, the reason it is very important to designate the areas or elements of conflict for space and time and to define it is because once you can define it and once you can put names on it, you can assess what you control in any given conflict. You can say, do I control force here? Do I have all my guns online in angles that they can shoot? Or do I have my hands in my pockets, or are my hands up in a position that I can begin to affect the enemy? We break down force into potential force and actual force. So if I have my hands in my pockets, well, potentially I could punch them, but I got my hands in my pockets. So actually I can't punch them. But if I get my hands out of my pockets and get them up, now that force becomes actual force, something that can be applied in reality. And then we look at space, footwork, movement. If you're sitting in a chair during this fist fight that happens, and that guy's standing over top of you, space is not something that you have at your disposal. Now, you can get up from that chair and push him back and kind of gain some movement, or you can come out of that chair and flip it around in between you and him, creating a barrier and also creating space. What are the different ways that I create space and control space? If I'm fighting a guy and I push him into a corner, I want to keep him from being able to flank on me and angle on me. I want to put him in a corner and sit him down and start throwing some elbows. You know, I want to control space so that my force is more effective. Yeah. And time, I want to go first, and it's my turn every turn. Yeah. You know, I watch people train in martial arts, and they do a drill, and they're never taken out of the drill. They do the drill where it's like, you know, strike, block, strike, parry, block, strike, you know, and it's like almost a choreographed exchange. Well, you're saying it's his turn, my turn, and then it's my turn and his turn, and then it's his turn and my, like, it's my turn every turn. Like, we don't train to give them a turn, you know. I tell people all the time, you know, it's funny, you could be standing in front of 20 Navy SEALs and you say, you know, hey, when you put your hands up in front of you and you're like this, you know, who taught you that? Your uncle, your dad, you know? And they go, yeah, my dad taught me that. I'm like, well, tell him he didn't do you any favors. Because when you stand in front of someone and pick your hands up, what are you saying? You know what you're saying? It's your turn. Go ahead. Like, all right, let's fight. Your turn. That's what you're saying. I'm not putting my hands up like that. I'm not saying it's his turn. He's going to get hit in the middle of a conversation that we're having with my hands that are up and I'm moving around, or I have some kind of hand position, but that hand position is not, okay, it's your turn. Okay, go ahead. Take a shot. You know, no, it's my turn. Every turn I start the show off, I'm going to hit you. And then I'm going to keep hitting you until you're horizontal and unconscious. Yeah. So this is not a game. This is not a sport that we're playing, and it's never your turn. It's always my turn. And take that mentality. Now, look, if he's good enough, he'll find a way to have a turn, and you might not have anything that you can do about it. And that's life. And you know what? Let's get the turn back. And it's going to be my turn every turn. I slipped up a little bit, and he stung me. I backed up a little bit, but now I got to get time back on my side now. So, you know, don't drill to have, to give him a turn. I'm not giving him any turns.
It's so important that the terminology you use and how you talk to yourself.
Yes.
Like, you know, like this attacker defender stuff. It's just like, no, you're never a defender.
No.
And people think that's macho bullshit, and it's not. It's when you talk to the alpha person, you're like, go to prison systems. Those guys never see them on the losing side of violence.
No.
They can't imagine it. All they do is they'll look at something, they'll say, and whoever the winning side of that was, if they're really good, they'll go, I like that, but I would have done it this way. Meaning they would find an even better way to have done what was already successful.
Yeah. And these are guys where violence is, they have to understand it.
Yeah.
It's not a game. It's not a game to them. This is their life.
Yeah. So, that's a hard concept for people to get, you know, protecting your mind that way.
That's right. So force, space, and time is a way that we can analyze what we did, look at it afterwards and go, did I control space there? Man, I could have jammed this. I could have got back and drawn my pistol because my rounds fly out of the end of my gun and I don't need to be up in that guy's face. I could have gotten some range and transitioned to a different weapon system and used that space to apply force over a very small time frame and won that whole engagement, you know, rather than getting a fist fight with a guy. Maybe it was a bad situation. So, you know, the thing is you're constantly evaluating whatever happened, and you can look at any video, and I do video analysis like we all do. Anyone who's serious in this business that we're in takes advantage of the millions of videos that are online of people getting stabbed and shot and beat up and all that stuff. And there are great lessons to be learned there. But when we look at a video and we analyze it, we want to be able to analyze it in the most effective way possible. And that means let's get language, and I've heard you use very clear language, very scientific language, of what exactly is happening here, let's put a name on it so that we can reference that. We can talk about it philosophically. We can talk about it scientifically. You know, without the proper language, you can't do that. So, you know, who's the feeder here? You know, we say feeder, receiver. Is this guy feeding? Is he, does he maintain the feed throughout the entire event? You know, does he give up the feed? Does this force element come in and he backpedals and he gave up the feed and allowed that guy to get to tee off on him because he saw another guy come into the frame? This, he put the brakes on because he wasn't ready for that. And rather than angle on the first guy and take the fight to him, he paused. And when he paused, they attacked him, you know, and this is a, as an example, you know, but if we don't have the right language to speak about it and have conversations, we're not going to learn everything we can learn from watching that video. So we have a lot of language that we have, and force, space, and time are a way for us to analyze it, talk about it, discuss it. So we have to put names on it, and we have to, you know, take this and break this down so we can extract from this video all of the valuable information that's there. And I've heard you do it as well. So
yeah, but your framework is so great because, you know, feeder, receiver, centile, you get that right away. And then you put it within those components. And then now everybody has the same language. Everybody knows what's going on. It's easy to understand. You can get a group. They don't have to be PhDs to figure that out. But now you can have that intelligent conversation each and every time. And as soon as the guy, you know, if you step to the guy, go, hey, you're the receiver now. Oh shit. You know, guy gets it right away.
I did that.
You know, it's just clear language is just so important, especially when you're dealing with, you know, the topic of violence. You know, you want to be very clear with people on what, you know, what you're asking or what you're telling them to do, you know?
Yeah. And you know, we don't have that much time. We have a certain amount of time that we have to, you know, pass this information on and analyze this. So as efficient as we can be with our language allows us to, you know, kind of get more work done in a certain given space of, in a certain amount of time. So,
well, hey, I want to transition over into something that is really, you know, I really love learning from you on this. Is, I guess the best way for me to put it is, what is the biggest misconceptions you see people have when it comes to blade work? And how you approach it. There's just a proliferation of, you know, all of a sudden everybody's making knives, everybody's using stuff, but your approach to it's really well. And your system is very spot on it. What do you see the biggest misconceptions are that are out there?
Yeah, that's great. Well, some of the misunderstandings are not unique to knives, but they're unique to weapons. Meaning, hey, when you draw a weapon, you are volunteering for a whole bunch of things that could happen. And, you know, don't be confused about that. Like if that blade leaves your sheath and is in your hand, it changes the environment, and you need to take that and be aware of it, be respectful of it. You know, you can get shot by a guy you don't even see, who thinks you're the bad guy as soon as you put a weapon in your hand, you know? So when you're doing that, you have to understand it before you produce that weapon and have it in hand, understand the seriousness of what you're doing. That's one thing. The other thing is people take blades and they believe that they're going to cut people and have this kind of immediate response, that the same, they think the same thing about pistols, you know. They shoot somebody and they think that that guy is going to immediately be incapacitated. And that's just not the case. And there's a certain amount of time that it takes for any of these weapons to be useful. In other words, to have some effect on the target that's going to make a change in the fight in your benefit. Blades can be immediate if you cut what we call switches. Switches are circulatory and respiratory. I'm sorry, our connective tissue and nervous system. And then the other type of target is a timer, which is circulatory and respiratory. So bleeders and airway and that stuff. You have timers and switches. So switches are immediate. If you cut a tendon or you cut a nerve bundle, that mechanically will stop working immediately. You cut the wires that send the signal, or you cut the actual structure of the tendons and ligaments that hold something together. That's immediate. When you cut them, you'll see an immediate response. But understand that that's typically localized and it's not lethal. In other words, if you stab someone in the brachial plexus and you deaden an arm, that arm is dead immediately. But his other arm works perfectly fine. It's localized. So yeah, you can get immediate responses, but they're typically localized and they're not lethal. Now you could hit timers, and timers are circulatory and respiratory. So you're cutting bleeders, you're disrupting the lungs, the diaphragm, the airway, etc. With a blade. Yeah, that you'll shut down the whole body, you know, because he's going to die. He will become incapacitated before that. He'll be confused. He'll get sleepy. But here's the thing. It takes time for all that to work. So you have timers and switches. Each one has an advantage and a disadvantage. But that is very rarely understood by people. So they just are like, you know, they don't access targets effectively, because they don't have targets categorized by timers or switches. They just stab a guy in the chest and they're hoping to hit something that's going to immediately turn this guy off. And there isn't anything in the chest that immediately turns anyone off. You know, that guy, you could stab him in the heart and he could be a dead man walking, but he's still walking. And he'll draw his pistol and empty his mag into you and then lay down under the tree and die. But you got all the rounds in you too, you know? So I try to get people to understand the realistic effects of these weapons, blades. And so they can work on it. Like, there's going to be control techniques. If you're going to stab a guy and you think that you want to incapacitate him, you're probably going to have to incapacitate him physically while he's bleeding out. Like, you're not just going to stab him and walk away. He'll shoot you in the back. Right. So, those types of unrealistic understanding of the world, you know, of how things work, physically, mechanically. And then other things that I think are interesting are people's misunderstandings of the proper structure and design and shape of blades that are to be used in combat. You know, how should the handles and blades and the physics behind it? You know, we do a lot of study in blade design, handle design, sheath design, carry system designs. And the average person out there making blades or selling blades or even teaching blade work doesn't have a good enough understanding of these things to pass it on to the student. You know, why is a blade designed a certain way? What are the advantages and disadvantages of this type of handle design? You know, what parts of the handle designs were made just for producing that blade from a sheath and are not part of the fighting aspect or for the drawing of the blade? Or, you know, a blade of this length and this weight, realistically for combat should have this type of point on it, not this type of point, or this type of edge, not this type of edge. And all of those types of understandings need to be understood by the people teaching, because the people that are learning are going to them and saying, hey, what should I buy here? How should this be? Where should I carry this, et cetera, et cetera. You have to have an understanding of all that to answer those questions effectively, you know? So I see that as not being understood well in the knife world. You know, I go to a blade show and there's thousands and thousands of blades that you're walking by all the tables full of blades. And most of them are not even made. They're flawed in their design, but they look cool. And a lot of times that's what people are looking for. You know, looking for something that looks cool. But as far as functionality, practicality, you know, people don't understand it the way that I think they should. So I don't know. That's just a couple of things that come to mind when you ask when you ask that question. You know.
Well, you've taken that. All your weapons approach, like your approach with shooting, is really interesting. You know, the way you guys train, and I know some people you train with, and what's interesting about that is it's training for what's a real gunfight is going to be like. You know, what you're truly going to do, not punching poles and paper.
Yeah.
But you know, the idea of movement is just like, it's almost, and I understand why most of the range is the safety thing they're trying to do. Just trying to get ready across. I get all that. But what's really interesting is if you're training, you know, if you've bought a weapon, I mean, God knows what, we got almost 10 million new gun owners now. And I bet a vast majority of them probably never shot the thing, got it out of the box. The ones that did probably just, you know, did basic training. They wouldn't know what to do, you know, online. Right. And that's not a slam against them. It's just a reality that the tool is not, it can actually be detrimental to you if you don't know how to properly use it. And what I really got schooled in just the last couple of years working with, you know, some of the people is just, you know, I've upgraded some of my training. It hadn't been upgraded in quite some time. And man, completely different world that's being trained right now. And it's exciting. It's fun, but it's very different from the old days. And that idea of movement, you know, it's the same thing, force, space, and time.
Yeah,
all there, and you guys are very consistent all the way through, in how you guys train across the board.
Yeah, I mean with the firearms, everything needs to be integrated because we are going to use in a real situation, you're probably not going to be using one type of violence tool. You know, in other words, I tell people a lot of gunfights start out as fistfights.
Right.
So. You know, if you lost the fist fight, maybe you don't ever even get your gun out. You know, a lot of shootings started out as stabbings. You know, if you don't know how to counter the edge weapon and produce your pistol, you get stabbed to death with a pistol in your holster. But, you know, you couldn't transition. I tell people a master of weapons is a master of transition. That's plain and simple. A master of weapons is a master of transition, meaning I've got to be able to go from hands at my side to horizontal elbow strokes to the chin. You know, I have to be able to transition from an elbow to a blade draw or a pistol draw. I've got to transition from my pistol being concealed to my pistol being out in my hand and working. I need to transition from being stationary to moving laterally as I transition from having nothing in my hands to having my pistol in my hands. I have to transition from this threat with my pistol to the next threat with my pistol. A master of weapons is a master of transition. So we're not ever going to be in a situation where our weapons are out, they're online, and there's no movement or change or transition that's necessary for me, and I'm just going to pull the trigger on that guy. That's not how it works. You know, that's
the other thing that's interesting with what you guys do too, is that you all know your movement and the way you train is universal, and everybody knows how you're going to move. You know, they know what you're going to do. You're assuming you're going to probably be working in tandem or working together. And then if you have to help each other with weapon transfers or anything like that, you take it down to like a gnat's ass on all of that, you know, on exactly how you do things. And you don't have to go into that. I just think it's just critical that you guys have gone all the way there. You take nothing for chance. You don't want to have to make it up on the fly. And you guys have literally thought about all the things that everybody just wants to punch holes in targets. They don't want to talk about movement patterns. They don't want to talk about how to move, how to do all these things, because those drills aren't as sexy, you know, and yet those are the critical things.
Yeah. And, you know? And the thing is, it is a function of, you know, the square ranges are built with liability as a key element. You know, they don't want people shooting themselves. And honestly, most of the classes that I teach for civilians, shooting classes, are the basic using of a pistol, loading and unloading, and you know, working out of a holster is like advanced for the class.
Yeah.
Because I can't do with these people what I would like to do with them, which is, you know, I explain to them, training should mirror reality, right? We already know that. Because if we're training for a real situation, if we're training for a sport, that is the reality that we're training for. Yes. Like if I'm a competitive shooter, the reality that I'm training for is a competition. But we're still training for reality. Whatever that reality is, that's what we're training for. If I'm training in combatives, I'm training for the reality of a real life fight. Okay. If you were training for a competition, you would want to know all the rules in the competition and how it's going to run so that I can train appropriately for that competition. Well, in the real life fight, I have to know all of the physical characteristics, the statistical probability of this happening over that happening, all the different possible combinations of things happening at different time and space. So when you start to analyze it, you're like, wow, this is a very complex thing that we're looking to train for. Well, I can still look at statistics of how things go, and I can still train for them, right? So if I say our training should match reality, everyone goes, yes. Okay. How often do you think the guy you're shooting at is going to be standing still? And they go, not much. I'm like, maybe 10% of the time he'll be standing still. How much of the time do you think it's a good idea for you to stand still? And they're like, probably not a great idea. I'm like, probably not, since we're not going first necessarily, because we're the good guys, right? So there's an emerging threat that is coming at us. We're having to respond to this. So we're automatically behind in the very beginning of this. So yeah, we're not going to be standing still either. So if I say 90% of confrontations will be me moving and the guy moving, and we want our training to mirror reality, we should 90% of the time in training be shooting things that are moving while we are moving. Now, if everyone just thinks back to their training, what percentage of the time do you spend on the range shooting moving things while you are also moving? And I would guess it is very fucking small. It's not 90%,
no,
which is what it should be. But what's the real, you know, what is the rub there? I can't do that training with people because they're going to be shooting themselves through their legs, yeah, and shooting their own hands and all kinds of crazy shit. But people aren't ready to do that. So we spend a lot of time doing very basic stuff. But when I'm training guys at a tier one military group, most of the time we are shooting and moving. Yeah. And we are, you know, and a lot of times we realize that the ultimate training for firearms is done with sims and not live fire. And a lot of people look at it as a hierarchy of training and they're like, you know, we're air gun stuff or blue gun, and we'll cert pistols, and then we'll do sim training, and then live fire is the top level training in a shoot house shooting live guns. And that is not, it is important to do live fire training, but we can do so much more that mirrors reality with sims, because I can have guys moving in any way, shape, or form that we can imagine, and you can shoot them with a gun that approximates the actual gun that you're going to be shooting them with. And They're hit with paint rounds that are, to the best of our ability, simulated to mirror what real rounds will cycle your weapon and all that stuff. So the ultimate training for combatives is done with simunition, not live fire. And that's where we spend a lot of our time in the firearms training is setting up drills that are simunition drills, but they are similar to range drills. And instead of shooting paper, we're shooting role players that are doing certain movement and repetitive. Like, we're burning these for reps, just like we would shoot a paper drill on a square range. Right. So I have a role player who works for me, and I tell him, you're going to start in that chair with your hands on the table. When I say go, you're going to jump up from that chair, you're going to draw a pistol, and you're going to laterally move in this direction 25 feet. And the operator is going to draw his pistol and shoot you while you do that. Okay. And then the drill happens. Reset, sit in the chair. Okay. Go ahead, load the next mag. Again, 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 again. It's not a scenario. It's right. Not, hey, I'm going to go right or left here at this doorway. It's none of that. It is a drill where you are shooting a moving person with a gun, which closely represents your actual gun that you're going to have in real life. So that's the best way of training some of the mechanics and applications. So that's what we do with a lot of the firearms training is we start to go down that road of situational, what we call situational training or situational drills, where we establish a situation and we run at full speed, and we run at full speed with simunition. And so that's, and then we'll incorporate combative things in it, and we'll incorporate blades and other things. But a lot of the drills that we end up doing, and almost nobody does that. You know, if people are using simunitions, they're usually doing scenario-based drills.
Yeah.
Which is, hey, there's a hostage in there, and we want you guys to go in and get them. And they're trying to figure out which way they're going to go and how they're going to breach and how they're going to make entry and how they're going to flow. But it's all very much unique to that one event. We do situational drills, which is, I'm going to tell you exactly what's going to happen, and then you're going to execute it with perfect motion, perfect drawing of your pistol, tracking of the targets. You're going to land a perfect spear elbow on this guy, and then you're going to draw simultaneously and shoot this guy in his pelvic girdle as you draw your blade and hook his throat. And, you know, so it's like a very complicated range drill where you're allowed to shoot real people and stab them with aluminum trainers and, right. And punch them and elbow strike them and knee them and all the other stuff, grab them and choke them and all that stuff. And we can do it because we use sim for those drills, but it's not a scenario, you know? And that's the thing that we have to kind of retrain the tactical world, because as soon as sim guns come out, everyone thinks that they're going to make decisions, and not in these drills. You're not. That's a scenario. You're not making any decisions. You're executing perfectly certain movements under pressure, under time pressure and actual force pressure. So anyway, that's
the feedback you guys must get on that is amazing, because now guys are seeing real profiles that, and it's not the first time they've seen it when they're downrange. They're right. Used to seeing people move. They're used to moving and shooting. They're used to stuff that was never done before at that level, you know, that way. And that's interesting. And it's such a, like you said, yeah, you sim is the standard, you know, for that.
We can get closest to reality.
Yeah. Because you can use real bodies. You can use yep. real movement, real people in doing all that. And again, yeah. it's so counter to what, you know, is out there. And it was introduced to me. It made so much sense immediately, but yeah. It was like, you feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm breaking that, you know, the real gold standard is live fire. And you realize, no, live fire right. is important. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But
the hardest thing is finding targets, like people who are like, and I, when guys who work for me, I say, look, we're going to do situational drills. They're going to use simunition, and you guys are going to be the targets. And you're going to be doing the same thing over and over and over again for them to work on this drill. Yeah. You're going to get shot with 900 sim rounds today. So, you know, put your mouthpiece in and buckle down, and that's the job. And yeah. It's hard to get people to want to do that. You know, yeah. You know, they'll play paintball if they're allowed to in the house and play the barricaded shooter. But when they just have to get shot, and you're a very complicated target, you're a very complex target, being that you're human, and you know, people don't want to do it. So, but if you can get the role players to do it, it's great drills, it's great training, you know.
Well, listen, man, I want to respect your time, but I just want to kind of close out. Hey, what's your view? And I don't really necessarily mean it from a political standpoint or anything, but just I've never seen a degradation of our society as quickly as what's happened in the last year and a half here. And yeah. Just some of the things, and people approaching me that I've known for years, they've never trained with me or anything like that, know of me, but just people are just lost right now. And people are making a lot of irrational decisions when it comes to their personal safety and stuff. Any yeah. just general guidance you could give people on, like, the uninitiated on, you know, where we're dealing, because for first time people have, because of my travel and because of the circles that you're in, what you do, yep. We've seen collapses. We've seen society, other places collapse real fast. I'm used to operating in collapse societies. Mm-hmm. But this is really, I've never seen it hit our country the way it's hit our country and divided us as much. And even within the military itself,
yeah,
the issues that I'm seeing, I'm a former officer, you know, between the officer corps and the enlisted, it's tragic what I'm seeing happen right now.
Yeah. I mean, there is a breakdown of the very foundation fabric of our society, and it's a planned thing. I mean, it's something that, you know, there are people with that are anarchist, or they might not even refer to themselves as anarchists, but they basically want to destroy structure. Yeah. And that structure that they're destroying, they look at as potentially some type of confinement or something that's controlling them or not allowing them to, you know, live the way they want to live. But more times than not, it's somebody else is living a certain way and they want to control those people. In other words, it's those anarchists, not... They don't just want to destroy the structure and the foundation. They want to tell you what you can and can't do. So they're looking to take away your freedoms. And these types of things have eaten away at the foundation of our society, and they have eroded certain structures. And the family is one of those. Yeah. Religion is one of those. These things are foundational to each individual's stability, right? So when you look at a group of people or society, it's just made up of individuals. And if collectively those people are more destabilized, then your society is destabilized. If your family, which is part of the thing which a lot of people gain their initial structure from, their initial training, how to live the life and to be productive and effective. If that's broken down, that person doesn't have the same amount of structure or the same amount of capability or stability. And so collectively, the entire society begins to weaken. And the same could be said for any of the institutions which produce an understanding of virtue, right? So it all gets back to virtue, you know, and the virtues: strength, courage, honor, loyalty, mastery. You know, these virtues are passed on from our fathers and our mothers and our grandfathers and our uncles and the entire family structure. Plants the seed of these virtues in young minds. And then the other stabilizing forces, whether it's religion or kind of the other groups that kind of give us structure and all that stuff are being undermined and weakened. And therefore there's a weakening of the individual. And so collectively the society, which is made up of individuals, is weaker and more destabilized. And we're going to see this in everything, whether it's the military or because as young people move out into these areas, you know, they're not going to have the tools, the virtue that it takes to be strong and to be true and to be honorable and to, you know, understand freedom and the respect that you should have for each other and all that stuff is all getting undermined. And in its place, we have like this progressive leftist ideology, which is people are triggered and, you know, words are violence and, you know, you can't say certain things, you can't do certain things. Stereotyping like racism is rampant and it's mostly racism against white people, you know. Yeah. There's all kinds of things that are happening, and of course those people who are racist don't even recognize them because they have by definition defined themselves as it's impossible to be racist towards white people or men. You know, so a young white man in today's society is he's going to have some hurdles to get over. But the family structure is being destroyed. The structure of our educational system, if it was ever really there, is weakened, politicized. The government, to me, seems to be more divided and corrupt, mostly because of the division. Everyone's against everyone else, but you know, all of these things, and then you add on it an increased authoritarian government based on, you know, protection of the people through COVID and the pandemic and all that stuff, and the new kind of power vectors that the government has, you know, because it's an emergency, right? All these things undermine freedom. They undermine self-reliance. All of the virtues that are valuable in individuals start to get undermined, and it affects everything in our society. So the police are, you know, this anti-police movement. Yeah. The police are just another structure in our society, which brings stability. So if you undermine that, you destabilize the society. If you look at it over and over again, all of these things are destabilizing our society. And we're seeing the effects already. You know, we're seeing crime rates change. We're seeing police retiring and not wanting to go out. I mean, you know, we're looking at a very dark time, I think. And I don't really see the mechanism for changing it. In other words, no. I think that we're going in that direction. And,
Everybody I know is planning for that because nobody can see any way of resolving this. The thing that I think people just have to be aware of is understanding the fact that we probably are going to be seeing more turmoil, more violence again, more disruption. Yeah. And it's not necessarily going to go away. And with what I've always remembered from overseas is if you think the current structure, whatever you think is so bad right now, when you take it out, what gets replaced with that vacuum is just, it's horrific, man.
Ugly.
You know, and that's what people don't understand is that, you know, there is no utopia. There will be a vacuum film and it will not be, it'll be more tyrannical. It'll be more oppressive. Yeah. And, you know, it's just not, you know, it's just not worth it. But I've never seen a time in the country where I felt more, you know, I mean, growing up on military bases and stuff, everybody was, we were a country. We were all Americans. Yeah. And we were all coming in, all different backgrounds. I mean, we all just joked and did stuff like that. But I've never seen the country just so polarized and so tribalized.
Yeah, yeah, you know? It's true.
And you know, being in the biz right now, and just some of the inquiries I get are really unique from people that never had an interest in training or anything like that. They're scared. Right. They're just scared, man.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't really know. It's not the best thing to end on, but I was interested in your level, because I love the fact that you're working with the groups that you're working, and then you're giving this dynamic, ever evolving training. I mean, that's just such a, it's always great, because everything else I hear about is just deteriorating. It's just going down, you know, or people going down roads, or like you said, it's some sort of a, you know, money-making mill or something like this. I mean, you guys, you can tell, you know, when your guys are around, you guys are fully involved, you're fully committed. And, you know, I just encourage anybody, I'm sure this provokes a lot, you know, you're not going to get to work with Tom and his group, but you can probably, there'll be ways that we'll have in the show notes that you can reach out and get more information, because, I got to tell you, just got a quality program, quality group of guys that you've trained. And, I really, really appreciate your time and sharing this with everybody. Cause I know you're busy all the time, and, This was really just a fun conversation to have.
It's a great honor for me to get a chance to talk to you too. Thank you.
Well, listen, all the best, Tom.
Yep.
And that is Tom Kier. So glad I got to bring it to you. Remember, SOC Tactical Group. We'll put stuff in the show notes for you guys to get a hold of the SOC Cali people. And also, you know, send your questions and continue to send your questions. And Tom's been pretty understanding that he will absolutely answer any of the questions that you guys have based on any of the information that we put out here. Now, understand, you know, at the end there, we're talking, this is just, we're seeing things. Tom's seeing it at a very different level than a lot of people are seeing it at, because of course, when you're dealing with the groups that he's dealing with, they have to respond to a lot of stuff. You know, you get privy to things that are going on. I don't think it's being scaremongering to say that the fact that you're watching this channel and the fact that you're seeking out information from subject matter experts like the ones I'm bringing and all the inquiries I'm getting, this time rivals anything in my career. I thought 9/11 was going to never be outdone, but this last year and a half, I've never seen people so interested in learning how to better protect themselves and their family. But as you saw from Tom, the punching, the kicking, and all of that, very important. Using the tools, very important. But really, it's developing, you know, your mind, your strategy, making sure you have a strategy. So again, I'd re-listen to his concepts on force, space, and time. They're very easy to understand and very critical to your self-protection strategy. So, again, thank you. Please go to timlarkin.com, get your free masterclass. Please send your friends there. Share this channel, especially interviews like this. You know, let people know they're available. And until next time, stay safe.